We're going to take your calls and continue chatting with Dr. Eben Alexander this hour. Proof of Heaven is his work. Incredible story how he passed on to the other side and came back to talk about it. You'll be able to hear more of Dr. Alexander's interview with our reporter Linda Moulton Howe during her November segment, so make sure you're part of that. The end of November, Linda spent some time with Dr. Alexander today, bringing you a different perspective. So you're gonna enjoy that as well. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final hour, Dr. Eben Alexander will take your calls as well. Dr. Alexander, this feeling of heaven and hell, how did you feel about that?
Well, my experience, as I had alluded to a little while ago, started out in this realm that was very coarse and murky and underground, monotonous, unresponsive. It certainly was a very foreboding place as I thought back on it. And I really think that that was the best consciousness that my brain could muster, soaking in pus with severe meningitis. Now, some people, if I had come back from that and described that realm, I think that many would assume that I had had what's called a hellish NDE, a hellish near-death experience. My current thinking is that those experiences may very well be partial. In other words, that people just haven't gone in deep enough. And in fact, the majority of near-death experiences reported over the last 40 years, say 90% or more, are the ones that are involve that incredible sense of love and of comfort and of divinity and seeing departed loved ones. So the majority of them actually go all the way through and have that transcendent quality, whereas a small minority, 5 to 10%, involve that kind of hellish component, and I think, again, that's because they're incomplete. Now, in terms of hell itself, that is not something that I journeyed through, if you assume that that earthworm eye view place was not a hell or purgatory, and I don't believe it was. However, I do believe that the way all of this works, and this is based on my experience, but then also with a lot of the learning I've had to do after my experience, is that we actually judge ourselves, our higher soul, and our soul mates in our life review, and that is something that happens as we pass over into that next realm and review in detail the more important facets of our life in dealing with others, and we live any of the evil or mayhem or injustice that we've dealt out to others. We feel it even more strongly in that spiritual realm as the recipient when we go through that life review. And I think, in fact, we're our own worst judge as that higher self, and that is all part of our souls ascending to a higher level by trying to live by the rule of giving out that love of the Creator, that infinite unconditional love, as much as we can. And we do pay the price when we haven't done that, when we've been governed by greed and ego and selfishness in our dealings, or that is something that we end up paying the price during those life reviews. I did not come back from any of this thinking that the concept I'd had of heaven and hell, say in my childhood and in early years, that there is a hell out there. I do not believe that this deity, this incredibly loving and absolutely omniscient and omnipotent creative source that I met, and again, who many would call God, but to me is so much more awesome than our typical depictions of God, that creator would make a place of eternal damnation that is part of the Christian idea of hell. To me, that makes absolutely no sense, because that would be such an imperfection in that realm. created by such a perfect deity. Now, I did come to see the purpose for evil and for injustice, and that has everything to do with our manifestation of free will, so that to allow ascendance of our souls in that higher realm, we need to more and more manifest that unconditional love, which involves none of the selfish or jealous qualities that often affects love in this earthly environment, but truly unconditional love as best as we can manage, that's coming directly from that creative source through us. And that is a natural link once you realize the connection of our consciousness as being a manifestation of that divine within each and every one of us.
If you have a good person like yourself and you pass on, and next to you is some serial killer, some evil person who has created incredible harm on this planet, do you think you both go to the same place, or do you both separate? You go to a higher realm, he goes down to the bottom level.
Well, what another kind of concept that comes into this that I wrestled with long and hard after I came back, and it has to do with especially the suffering of innocents, such as children and animals. And because in the setting of that omnipotent God, because the God that I saw was absolutely powerful beyond all measure and yet also infinitely loving. And it was very hard to reconcile that with the suffering of innocents and animals without invoking the idea of reincarnation and that our souls are eternal. And it's not just they make this one passage through incarnation on earth and then eternally thereafter exist in, you know, a heaven or a hell, but that in fact they are ascending towards that godliness with multiple reincarnations. And the reason that's important is in your example, and believe me, I am no saint, okay? I don't want anybody thinking that I'm putting myself up there as a saint, because I'm not. And I've, you know, I try to do my best and to be honest and to learn from my mistakes and my faults, and I'm absolutely not a saint. Luckily, I'm not a serial killer either, and I think that, going back to your example, that the serial killer would end up having, for one thing, a much tougher life review, because he'd have to live through feeling the pain and anguish that he'd dealt out to every victim and every family member, and he would have to personally go through that, and not only that, but do it in that spiritual realm where it's a much more pure, intense kind of emotional event than it is down here in the physical realm. And then, of course, given that the ascendance of our souls in that outer realm is towards that godliness that has to do with the fact that the main fabric of the universe is that love of the Creator, and that the evil is a trace impurity, he would have to make up a lot of lost ground by, you know, having to kind of the net gain towards that all-loving state, he would have to make up for. From having dealt out so much evil in this life, you either make up for it in this life or in another life. And so that's what he would have facing him, and I would hopefully have a lot less of that if I've spent much more of my life trying to do the right thing, trying to show compassion and love for others, and not being slave to the material realm. That's one of the problems with our secular culture, is if you think that everything is contained within, you know, that interval from birth to death, and the thinking he who has the most toys when he dies wins, well, that kind of thinking really creates for a very kind of a depressing existence compared to knowing the eternity of our souls, and that what we learn and the good that we do in this life, showing compassion and love for others, even in the face of injustice and evil, is something that helps us with ascending in that higher realm for all of eternity. And it just makes a lot more sense to me that it should work like that.
Did it give you any kind of impression, Evan, about reincarnation, this event?
Yeah, I would say To me, that must be a reality of just giving what I learned deep in my journey and also trying to process it as I've gotten back here. And again, it was just trying to reconcile that infinitely powerful, infinitely knowing and loving deity with the fact that we have such an imperfect world here that does have much evil and injustice, and especially the suffering of innocents, such as children and animals. There was no way for me to see that reincarnation did not play a role. It simply was the thing that made the most sense.
Okay, let's take some calls with you. Tim is a first-time caller. Winston-Salem, there you go, Tim. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, George. Thank you, Dr. Alexander. I just wanted to know, in this kind of disease state, what would a PET scan appear to be like? What kind of coloration or changes in imagery would you see that?
Well, basically, I did not have a PET scan done during the time, but you would see that a lot of the cortical activity would be diminished. Greatly diminished, that out over the surface of the brain. You might still have some islands of activity in the deeper structures. In my analysis of my experience, I came up with 9 different hypotheses trying to explain how this hyperreality could exist given the extreme destruction going on in my neocortex. And none of them, at the end of the day, fit the bill, even though there are structures deeper than the cortex, such as the basal ganglia, the thalamus, and parts of the brainstem that do play a role in consciousness. I would say that to have any kind of world constructed within your consciousness, you've got to have that very powerful calculator of the cortex, at least some part of the cortex. That would still be working. And I think, given the nature of meningitis, that I probably did have some neurons, especially at the deepest levels of cortex, which has 6 layers, that were still functioning. But given the connection between the columns that are the main calculating unit of the neocortex, there's no way that I had any kind of network of those elemental calculators working. I might have had isolated cells working, but no way that I had something more complex going. So that, to me, was the most difficult part of explaining this, trying to come up with a way that the brain could have managed such an incredibly rich, ultra-real, vivid, interactive reality that it put together for me that was very complex, and over an extended period of traveling out through the gateway and the core and then back down to the earth where my view, and to do that multiple cycles, have all these lessons and every bit of that, and then to try and assume, well, maybe it happened at the instant I was coming back out, or maybe when I was going into coma, or maybe it happened during coma, but because my cortex was somehow providing more than it seemed to be able to provide. But at the end of the day, none of those explanations work to explain that ultra reality. And when I then found that that's a very common feature in other NDEs, and especially some of the interleaving of multiple sensory modalities, and it goes far beyond just seeing 360 degrees, because I was becoming all of everything in higher dimensional space, seeing how time flow in that realm is completely different and has access to any point in our space-time. I mean, it goes so far beyond what my brain could even muster now. That's the part that finally convinced me that this was something that was happening out in pure consciousness, where my consciousness was free of the limitations of physical brain and mind.
There was a time, I believe, in life after death now, and I believed in it before. But there was a split second, Evan, that I didn't believe in it. I went to a funeral several years ago, and a friend of mine died in a motorcycle accident, and there he was in the casket. And I'm looking at him, and it just hits me all of a sudden that this is it for him. It's over, and there's nothing else. It's darkness. He doesn't even know he's dead. It's done. And it was the worst feeling I think I've ever experienced. It went away very fast. Like I said, I'm a believer in life after death. But for that moment, it was one of the darkest voids I had ever felt.
Well, I see that, you know, this body is a costume. It's a costume in this act of the play. And when this act of the play is over, I simply leave this costume behind. But, you know, thinking that the body and the brain are anything more than just a physical manifestation that serves temporarily as a vehicle for this much higher and more capable soul-spirit consciousness, it just makes far more sense to see that the consciousness is what, which really is our spirit and soul, is the part that is that spark of life within us. And just having the body there dead doesn't mean that the soul that temporarily used it has gone.
Let's go to Lebanon, Connecticut. Hello, Alan. Take it away. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay. Hi, George. Welcome back, Dr. Alexander. I have a question about who you met there. Those of us that are biblical students have written about that. It's said by Jesus the Christ that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in the kingdom of heaven. And Apostle Paul said he's present with the Lord when he's absent from the body. I wonder if you met any biblical message, any biblical people there, or any other person that gave you a message that you want to tell us about.
Well, I did not meet any of the biblical characters. And for B, I think it's important to stress that part of the very deep transcendental nature of my experience was having all of my life history deleted. Now, very importantly to me, especially when I started to read the NDE literature, is the fact that my father, who meant very much to me, he passed over 4 years before my coma. And he was absolutely nowhere to be seen. On the butterfly wing, there was this beautiful girl, and I could remember exactly what she looked like, what she was wearing, beautiful blue eyes and high cheekbones, a very wide smile, and light brown hair.
Did she mean anything to you in your living life?
Well, the thing is, you know, I kept, every time I went back through there, there she was on the butterfly wing, this very same girl. And I could remember her visually, and I could remember that beautiful, comforting love that she gave me. That was a memory that even now it just gives me shivers to think of that beautiful warmth and love and comfort from her. And yet, when I came back, as much as I could remember her visually and her clothes and her face and everything, I knew that I had never met that girl in my life. And so to me, those were two very serious problems, that my father wasn't there, and there's this beautiful girl who I came to call in my writings after, you know, I came back, was writing all this up. I started calling her my guardian angel. And then when I read all the near-death experience literature, I realized that people often see departed loved ones who are very meaningful. They'll see biblical figures.
Right.
And I just, to me, I knew I'd had a very profound experience that seemed to very much support other NDEs, and yet it was a real deal-breaker that my father wasn't there, and I didn't know who this woman was.
Hold on for 1 second, Evan. We're going to hit this quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to take more calls and let you finish that up on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, the Ghostbuster gals join us. We're going to have some fun with them. When we come back with Dr. Evan Alexander, we'll take some final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Evan Alexander with us. We're talking about his work, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. How do your colleagues and friends react to you now, Evan?
Well, I would say that my colleagues, many of them have had a very healthy skepticism about things. The more they know about consciousness, the more I think 5 or 10 minutes of discussing, you know, what I faced in trying to explain all this, and how my hypotheses trying to explain it in the brain failed. And of course, I get to the hard problem of consciousness, which is a scientific problem that I really didn't know very much about before my coma, but I've had to learn a tremendous amount about consciousness since my coma. And the hard problem really gets right at the crux of it. And the hard problem, very simply, says that we really don't have any idea, once we understand the physics, chemistry, biology, neuroanatomy, and neurophysiology of the human brain, to then describe how that generates consciousness. What I can tell you is there's not a soul on earth that knows the first sentence in that chapter of how the brain gives rise to consciousness. And that is a very vexing problem, and especially combined with the enigma of quantum mechanics, which basically says all the founding fathers of quantum mechanics were driven into mysticism because their experiments suggested that consciousness plays a major role in creating a reality, and they didn't know how to take that. And between the hard problem and the enigma of quantum mechanics, I think many neuroscientists can come around to understanding why my experience showed me very clearly that consciousness is primary and that spirit and soul are eternal and that they give rise to physical reality and brain.
Let's go to Sean, west of the Rockies, San Diego, California. Hi, Sean. Good morning.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Alexander.
Good morning.
I'm calling because I just recently came out of ICU. I passed away, and they brought me back. And I'm wondering if he was in a state that I was in, where you see yourself as a ghostly blue cloud figure.
So you basically saw your spirit, Sean, huh?
Right.
Yes. And I saw another spirit come to me.
Uh-huh.
Just recently passed away in San Diego, as he was an icon.
Uh-huh.
And the Lord was on the other side of me. And I cried. Did he cry to stay? Because I cried to stay.
Did you see anything like that at all, Evan?
Well, you know, I never really saw anything of me. There was no body there. I never saw any kind of I was just the awareness. I was you know, observing all this, and as I said, I did see this beautiful girl, and I saw many other souls that I did not know, but I think Sean, your description fits very well with what I think many people describe when they have that kind of near-death experience, where they say have a cardiac arrest in an ICU and then are resuscitated, and often do encounter a departed loved one, and can certainly be aware of the divinity of God, of the Lord there, and I think that kind of thing is quite common. And there were just the slightest similarities in my experience. My experience went very deep and, of course, involved this this guardian angel who I didn't really recognize from life, and yet I could visualize her face so well that I knew I'd never seen her before. And, of course, I was haunted by not having seen my father. I thought that was a glaring deficit in my experience.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's go next to Alyssa in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Alyssa. Or is it Alyssa or Lisa?
It's Alyssa.
All righty. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi, Lisa.
Dr. Alexander, did you leave with a sense of knowing that you would be coming back there? And did you experience any such thing as the tunnel, either coming or going? And anything that you can tell me that you recall about what your tour guides were like, and the angelic music, the colors you saw, the holographic scanning machine, or your life review, anything about you driving you to or from more religion and spiritual?
Yeah, well, it definitely, it's made me very, very spiritual. I mean, I now know the know that our souls are eternal, and for me, the experience was just absolutely stunning, and it was the kind of interplay of all the you know, the visual and auditory. I remember in thinking back on that beautiful scene on the butterfly wing with this beautiful girl and the other butterflies, millions of them, like rivers of living color, and going down into this lush greenery, coming back up, and the waterfalls, and this brilliant light from the clouds and color, and then the arcing orbs of light up above, and that were generating these hymns and these crescendo music, anthems, and chants. That so much of it, just you know, you can put all kinds of adjectives and words trying to describe it, and it's very difficult to do so. It really did not come in through normal sensory modalities, and that's part of the reason the memories are so kind of alive and yet seem in a sense somewhat alien to us, because they're not really like Earth-derived memories, in spite of the fact that the, you know, the scenery, some people would argue that was kind of Earth-like to have that greenery and all. But then, of course, outside of the universe in the core, with that deity and that glowing orb, that beautiful orb, I think, was really the interpreter. And there was a sense that there really were the three of us, of that deity, omniscient, all-loving, creator and source of all, and the orb, and then my consciousness. And the I also had a phase I went through when I was coming back. As I said, often that melody would open the gateway and let me back in. And I was always told, you'll be going back. You're here to learn many things, but you'll be going back. And there came a time when I could no longer use the melody to get in there. And I remember the sadness of that was immense. And it was like, you know, thunderstorms throughout all of the universe, this incredible power of depression that I'd been basically locked out of those, out of that gateway in that heavenly realm. And it was at that point that I saw these arcs of people out around me, kneeling and murmuring, and just thousands of them going off into the darkness, some holding candles, some hooded, but all the murmuring. And it was billowing me up on these beautiful clouds of bright energy. And I remember the feeling there was so much of that love that I only thought was available in the gateway and in the core. And yet I was finding that these arcs of people and all this murmuring around me was just bouncing me up with this wonderful sense of love. And when I was writing all that up later, and I could remember it so vividly, I realized that they were praying for me, and that was actually my kind of welcoming back to this realm. And it did show me the value of prayer and how prayer is very powerful. And what I often tell doctors, nurses, families is, you know, that prayer gets in. And we don't know what the divine plan is, and often it may not be what we're praying for. But the thing is, it's very comforting to the soul that is in there. Those prayers do get in. And so when I talk to medical, you know, to healthcare workers, I say, I don't care if your patient is, you know, is obtunded or is in a coma or is brain dead or is physically dead, the prayers do get in. And always assume that anything that you're saying around the patient or the family is saying or doing, always assume that it's being perceived by the patient, no matter what their state is.
Are you afraid to die, Evan, at this
Absolutely
point?
Absolutely not. I know it's simply a transition. You know, it is actually, I look at it more as an adventure. I mean, it's all about connecting with our higher soul and getting on with our higher mission and working with our other soulmates in that outer realm. And it's, you know, what we learn in this life and the good and compassion we show in this life helps us both between lives and in other lives. But death is merely a transition. As I said earlier, it's when this act of the play is over, I'm done with this costume. That's it. I don't get too attached to the costume.
Good for you. Let's move on. Let's go to Matthew in Wharton, West Virginia. Hey, Matthew, go ahead.
Hey, George, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Alexander, I'm highly interested in this subject. I was wondering if you had any exposure experience with any Carl Jungian philosophies about the idea that there is an initial dream that we have when we are a child before our consciousness is basically conditioned into the life that we live. And that dream is like the connection to our real self, actually like our own personal avatar into the other realm that you're speaking of. And I was wondering if the reason I asked this is you had mentioned that when the meningitis was in your brain, you felt as though it was like it was tearing down your consciousness. It was like eating away at your memories. And you got to this point where you were like an earthworm view of the world. And I was wondering if it's possible that maybe your subconscious was working at the time. And basically, like, the vision that you saw, not to say that it wasn't legitimately the other world, but if it was more maybe the maturation of that original dream that we're supposed to have, basically flavored by your experience in the material world, in a sense, like, he basically says you don't remember this dream, and it's basically like in a sense the carrot on the stick that's causing us to live our life and to have this desire to be alive is that original dream that we have, our personal understanding of ourself in existence as a whole, not just existence in the material realm.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had any, if there were any tests that you had gone through that were actually like recording the activities of your subconscious brain at the time, or if there was a connection between your consciousness and your subconscious while you were in that coma.
Well, I think, you know, that brings up a very interesting point. I've wrestled long and hard, you know, with my old view of kind of the brain and the conscious and the subconscious, and certainly some of the views of eminent psychiatrists over the last century or so about the subconscious and about the idea of a collective unconscious, you know, of a collective consciousness that underlies all of it. And in transpersonal psychology, often you run into these kind of concepts where you have the species mind. And, you know, I think it's fascinating because I've had to totally revise all of my thinking about, for one thing, consciousness and experience, and realize that it's not totally brain-based. And in fact, I think for me now, I see it that really nothing is brain-based, because I've gone beyond the point of thinking that the physical reality is the reality that we see it is. I mean, even the materialists, physics, leading edges of the physics and science are telling us that there's really no material to the materialism. You know, you get down and it's vibrating strings of energy, depending on what model you look at, but it's certainly not a solid, hefty world. And likewise, I've come to see that consciousness and subconsciousness and memory is really very heavily based outside of the physical universe. And so to try and answer your question, it really kind of takes me down to the deepest level of what I see as consciousness. And again, like I said, especially because of the hard problem of consciousness and my realization of the depth of that mystery and my answer to it, or at least my approach to thinking about it, and also the enigma of quantum mechanics. They both point us to a consciousness, to an awareness, to information that is actually not necessarily in the physical universe at all. And I think that is more to the point of your question. And in terms of the Jungian statement and concepts, I would defer more to, for instance, the reincarnation work that came out of University of Virginia, originally by Ian Stevenson, now being shepherded by Jim Tucker. Very good, solid work about how our souls are reincarnated. And we have some memories from previous lives that were well documented. In fact, Stevenson set out to disprove it all, thinking this can't be so. He was coming along in the 60s and 70s, And with brain-based neuroscience, he was thinking this is impossible, but he ended up finding so much evidence for it that he realized that there were well-documented cases of reincarnation of souls. And I think my current understanding of experience and of memory is a lot more based in those kind of reincarnation studies and in transpersonal psychology, where people actually have clinical experience with past life regression and with some of these reincarnation things. And that's more the way I look at it than kind of the Jungian view of a subconscious in a brain, in a, you know, a baby that's, say, in a utero and then born. I realize that, in fact, I have to look a lot deeper and a lot further back to understand kind of conscious memory. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Let's go to David. Time for maybe one or two more. Wyckoff, New Jersey. David, hope all is well with you. Did you get hit by the floods?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I knew.
There wasn't much water, really. That was a relief. We had tremendous wind. My trees are much damaged, large branches lying around. I'm here in the northeast of Wyckoff, is the western Bergen County.
Mm. At least you're okay.
The worst storm I have ever seen.
Yeah.
I lived in Florida 14 years. We never had a hurricane like this.
Sorry for all those people in your area. I have friends in New York City who just been devastated by this.
Go ahead, David.
The area is our electric came on back today. Much of the area.
Oh, that's fast. Out,
I think I don't really know.
That's fast. Do you have a question, David? Because we're almost out.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a researcher in this subject, listening to you with much attention. I'd like to. What insights have you gained about the purpose of living in this world? Perhaps this would vary from individual to individual, I would think. But for example, the usual response to this question is a platitude: "We're here to learn lessons." And this platitude, this doesn't go very far.
All right, let's get a quick answer from you, Evan. We've only got about 45 seconds left.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think that it has everything to do with a fuller appreciation of the lessons we're here to learn, and that we're doing it over multiple lives. We're doing it with other souls. Often my soulmates may be incarnated as what I see as my nemesis in this incarnation. I have to see the hardship, difficulty, and challenges, including illness and disease, both in myself and others, as opportunities for learning the lessons we have to learn and manifesting that unconditional love and compassion for others in my dealing with the injustice and with the evils that I encounter in this world. And, of course, as a healer, it has everything to do with how I treat disease, looking not just at physical but at mental, emotional, and the spiritual aspects of the soul that I'm dealing with and of the souls that that particular soul is interacting with in this incarnation.
Very
and, I mean, it obviously, I'm sorry we don't have more time to go into more detail, but it's a much richer view of seeing how our lives fit into this very widespread, reincarnated, and connected with other souls, even those who maybe our soulmates and appear to be our enemy in this life, but
right,
very much
Evan,
about learning the lesson.
Oh, thank you so much. Proof of Heaven. It's a great story, incredible book. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.